The Guardian.
Do you work in public services? Have you and your team made a difference this year? The Guardian Public Services Awards reward innovation and best practice across all public services. If you're making your sector more innovative, efficient, and imaginative, enter now to get the recognition you deserve. For more information and to enter, visit guardian.co.uk/public services awards. The deadline is midnight on Friday, the 12th of July. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Politics Weekly, I'm Hugh Muir. And it's billed as the week Labour got serious. But are we any clearer on what a Labour government would do in office?
The next Labour government will have less money to spend. If we're going to turn our economy around, protect our NHS, and build a stronger country, we will have to be laser focused on every single pound we spend.
The heads have spoken, who will listen? And summer's here and sleaze is back. A series of lobbying stings by journalists triggers a new drive to clean up Parliament. Could the solution be in direct democracy and recall elections? Joining me for all of this, The Guardian's political columnist Seamus Milne, economics editor Larry Elliott, and a political blogger Hopi Sen. A warm welcome to all of you. Now, for 3 years, Labour's policy booklet has seemed wafer thin. Reluctant to make too many promises, Ed Miliband has sidestepped specifics and spoken in pretty general terms about the kind of Britain he wants to build. And it's not always easy to understand phrases such as pre-distribution and responsible capitalism. They don't exactly trip off the tongue, or at least they don't trip off mine very easily. But this week, the two Eds, Miliband and Balls, came closer to nailing down some principles. Labour will broadly agree to limit expenditure to George Osborne's spending review figures to be announced in the coming weeks. And it will not reinstate cuts to child benefits for wealthy parents. Seamus, let me start with you. Ed Miliband is speaking as we record this, and Labour seems to be softening its stance on welfare as a universal system and moving to one that's more based on need. Is that the right way to go?
Well, I think it is a worry. You know, the two announcements on universalism, losing winter fuel payments for better off pensioners, and the indication today that they're not going to plan to reverse the cut in child benefit for the better off child benefit recipients. I mean, of course, you're talking about the better off, and it's, of course, it's not going to be a priority. But I think the worry is that it's an attack on the universal principle, universal benefits principle, which has been embedded in the welfare state and Labour, and Labour's sense of how fairness can be achieved and sustained in society. So I think that is a problem, and it'll open up ground for the Tories to continue down the same track. But I think the more concerning thing really is the stuff about the Tory spending limits in 2015-16.
So they'll be keeping them?
Well, it's hedged about with qualifications, and they're promising to borrow to invest, and that's all fine and good. But I think there's clearly an argument going on in the shadow cabinet about exactly what the commitments should be, and Ed Balls is resisting making any, obviously, until nearer the election. But I think the sense that the message that the public will get is that this is going to be, Labour's going to be austerity light. And, of course, that pushes some buttons, but in terms of offering an alternative and a sense that this is going to be a real shift and that Labour is going to do the things necessary to really kickstart growth in a different way in 2015, I think is being cut away. But there's also some very positive things, I think, about understanding what has driven the huge growth in housing benefit, for example, which is greedy landlords and, you know, targeting them. Same with, you know, subsidising low wages in the private sector. And all those things are important and good and new. But I think the overall envelope, if you like, about the fiscal stance is a concern.
Hope you're shaking your head already. We're very early into the podcast.
Just on the housing benefit point, I actually was much more positive about the Ed Balls announcement earlier in the week than I am about some of the welfare announcements today, mostly because I think there's not really true that there's a lot of fat to be squeezed out of the current welfare budget. If you look at the housing benefit budget, which has grown in real terms over the 94.5 to 2007-8 period, the real growth in the housing benefit bill is not in the private rent regulated sector, which in real terms is basically exactly the same at 5.3, 5.4, 5.4 billion, but in the registered social landlord sector, which has grown from about 1.9 billion to about 6.3 billion in 2007-8. So I think it's kind of a push to argue that greedy landlords are registered social landlords, because actually what's happening is you've seen a shift from effectively council housing being replaced by a large expansion of registered social landlords. So I don't think you can easily squeeze down on housing benefit and say, oh, it's just greedy private sector landlords. Now, there has been a big increase in housing benefit in the private sector since 2007-8, but that is primarily a result of the recession. It's the people who have suddenly lost their jobs, they're renting houses, they suddenly have to apply for extra support. That is the sort of cyclical change that is explicitly excluded from what Ed Miliband's talking today. So my concern is actually, whereas in Ed Balls' speech, the pain was quite upfront and kind of clear. You could see, you know, this is going to hurt, and you can almost begin to see the outlines of where it's going to hurt. In the speech today, there's a kind of still a sense that the pain is being evaded a little bit, that you can somehow solve this problem by just pressing down on private greedy landlords or by a slight change in the negotiating system for local councils. You can make a marginal difference there, but the idea that this will solve structural benefit reforms is true. In fact, the big dirty secret is the last 30 years of welfare budgeting in the UK has not been ridiculously generous. I mean, it's Thatcher, then Blair, basically. This is not an era of massive expansion of welfare, except in the working tax credits, which is support for working families, for people who are actually earning a living.
Larry, Ed Balls is key here, given that Labour have a problem in establishing its credibility in this area. Was his contribution in the week, do you think, an important turning point?
I think it was a big moment for Labour. I think that Ed Balls has three big problems to address when he became Shadow Chancellor. One was that people blamed Labour for all the problems of the economy. The second was to ensure that people thought George Osborne had got the wrong economic policy and he'd got the right one. And the third was to lay out what Labour would do in office. And I think he's only really been successful in the second of those. He's been remarkably successful in winning the argument about George Osborne's policies, which have clearly not worked. What he hasn't yet managed to do is get round the fact that, as the polls suggest, people still blame Labour for the mess that the current government inherited and had no real idea about what Labour would do when it gets into office. And I think that what he was doing today, or what he was doing earlier in the week, was to try and actually get round the first of those problems, to try and make it look as though Labour had changed and it wouldn't come into power and spend loads of money. I think the problem he's got, though, is that by doing that, it rather undercuts the second part and the most successful part of his argument so far, which is that Osborne's policies have clearly not failed. So if Osborne's policies have clearly not worked, then why is Ed suggesting continuing with exactly the same policies when Labour gets into power? I think that is a real problem for Labour, that the austerity light is going to be difficult to square with Osborne has completely ballsed up running the economy for the last 5 years. Those two things don't really marry that easily, and I think that's something that Ed has not yet managed to crack.
But Seamus, this is about either hardening the core vote or broadening the Labour vote, isn't it? Surely they have to sing the kind of song that Ed Miliband and Ed Balls have been singing this week.
Well, you know, who are you really appealing to? I mean, if you're looking at opinion polling, it's perfectly true that Labour has an economic credibility issue, which I think is related to the last government, clearly, and the crash and how that came about. And then there's also an issue about welfare and how that's perceived and how it's reported in the media. But, you know, on many of these issues, actually, the public is with the points that we've just been making. Public opinion is against the austerity programme. It's against, you know, George Osborne's policies. It knows that they've failed. The majority of people want a change in direction. They support, at the very least, slower and shallower cuts. And in fact, people want a programme of growth and investment. And actually, that's true about a lot of other things which the Labour leadership are very cautious about. So I don't think it's actually just about public opinion. It's really about the City of London, the markets, and how those are going to be approached. And it's important to have that argument now, I think, if a Labour government is going to be successful in changing direction and doing the things that are needed to the economy that would make a difference.
I mean, Labour's whole strategy really relies upon getting the economy growing again. Everything it says about investment and the welfare state is based around the idea that they've got to get the economy growing again. Because if they can't get the economy growing again, then the amount of resources available to them are going to be limited. That's what the current government is finding. If you have an economy which is essentially 2.5% smaller than it was 5 years ago, tax receipts are going to be much smaller. The amount of money you've got available to actually hand out in public spending is obviously going to be constrained. And Labour wants to avoid the sort of spending cuts and the welfare reform that the current government, if it wants to do that, then it's going to have to find a way of actually making the economy bigger and more successful. And that's what it's yet to actually persuade people it can do, I think.
So it's a subtle juggling act, and a lot of tap dancing for Ed Miliband to do as well, because he's talking about cutting welfare spending, but not that welfare spending linked to the economic cycle. There's a distinction that he's going to have to persuade the public or explain to the public. Do you think he's going to be able to do that?
I think it's going to be very complicated, because even if you look at the reporting today, it says Ed Miliband supports a cap on welfare spend and not a cap on structural welfare spend. And I think, you know, if the idea of a structural deficit is cloudy in the minds of the electorate, the idea of a structural welfare budget is even more cloudy in the minds of the electorate. I mean, you can just about create a mechanism that says, well, this is a structural welfare spend and this is a cyclical welfare spend, but I find it pretty difficult to imagine you can sell that as a political concept. However, I would say that what's important here is that Labour means it. If Labour is going into this, doing this purely, as was being suggested, as a kind of a tactical manoeuvre in order to kind of buy off the city or, you know, approach the electorate, they're going to be seen through on this. And I think that was the problem in January 2012, when there was an initial kind of, you know, burst of restraint rhetoric that said, well, all these cuts are going to have to be kept and not going to be able to increase public spend. And then that was backed off immediately. If Labour really wants to say, look, we can develop a programme which is effectively austerity-like, which will be a lot better than what the current government offers, which involves strategic investment in infrastructure, involves investment in industry, involves a slightly better profile of deficit reduction in terms of public service spending. I think that's an argument that is credible and there's an audience for that. But I think if it's, well, we don't really want to do that, what we want to do is spend an awful lot of money, but don't think we can get away with that, I think the electorate will see through that straight away. So if Labour is going to go for this kind of strategy, it really has to keep pushing at it and pushing at it and pushing at it. And I think the only way you can do that is by kind of embracing some of the pain that involves, because otherwise the electorate will just think, well, this is just words. You don't really mean any of this. And I think the slight problem with the announcements this week is the pain is tiny. You know, it's 100 million on winter fuel payments. This is pretty much insignificant. I think there's going to have to be some bigger pressures on exactly what you hold back and who you hurt. And I think part of that, actually, even as someone on the far right of the Labour Party's tax increases, I don't think you can credibly approach the 2015-16 to 20 kind of spending period without considering a fairly broad-based tax.
What about the details of this, Seamus? Because there are specific things they're talking about, like giving more powers to local councils to bargain down private rents and more house building. I mean, are these actually things that they would be, levers that they actually would be able to pull?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that the issue of house building is absolutely central. I mean, it's central both to, you know, kickstarting real economic growth, and it's also essential to tackling the housing benefit issue and the housing crisis, and the wider issue of that in society. So I think, you know, focusing on those issues is exactly right. The question is whether they go far enough. I think, are they going to move towards, you know, some form of rent control, rent regulation, as is very successful in other parts of Europe, which I think is clearly necessary to deal with some of the problems we've been talking about.
But rents are only rising in London. I mean, they're not rising anywhere else in the country. So you talk about rent control only in London.
Well, targeted rent controls. And then the second thing is the absolute central importance of house building and council house building in particular, which is an absolute, you know, economic no-brainer to borrow for investment or to channel printed money into mass investment, a mass council house building program, which would, you know, then get a revenue stream through rents very quickly. It's an absolutely central economic necessity, and I think actually that does unite the different wings of the Labour Party at the moment.
Looking broadly at this, within the electoral cycle, are they doing it right? Is it, if they are now breaking cover and actually putting out some policy, some detail of policy, are they doing it at the right time, do you think, Larry?
I think probably this is the right time. We're two years away from election. I think Labour has to start to flesh out what it would do in power. I think that, you know, people are quite used to the idea that the government hasn't actually done what it said it would do back in 2010. I mean, it's quite used to Ed Balls going on TV and saying George Osborne's policies are failing, and I think the public has taken that on board. But what it really wants to know now is, okay, you know, Labour was right, the Tories were wrong, but what would Labour do if it was in power? So I think it is an important time for Labour, and it has to start actually laying out the broad principles under which it would govern in 2015 and onwards. And I think the other point that Labour needs to address is what it's going to do about wages and pay, because yes, one reason that the welfare bill has been going up is because of tax credits. Tax credits have been used copiously to actually subsidise rotten pay for lots of people, and that's what pre-distribution is supposed to be all about. It's supposed to be about ensuring that people get a bigger share of the economic cake and a bigger share of their productivity increases.
Oh, that's what it's about.
Which they've not been getting. So, I mean, how are you going to actually raise the level of wages? And that's one reason that the economy has been poor in the last few years, which is that prices have been rising much faster than wages. Wages are going up by about 1% a year. Prices have been going up by 3% a year in the last year, but even higher rates of inflation previously. So people's real incomes are being squeezed. And if that's happening, then people are going to require top-ups to their salaries in order to give them a living wage. And this is an area that I've yet to hear what Labour's real policies are. Just getting employers together and asking them whether they'd like to give people a living wage seems to me to be a bit woolly. I mean, there are only two real ways of doing it. One is that you actually create a full employment society and give people higher bargaining power, or you actually give more power to trade unions. I mean, those are the two clearly obvious ways of doing it. I can't see any third way. And it'd be interesting to see which of those two or combination of those two Labour favours.
And have Labour done it right in terms of giving us enough information so they have some credibility, but not giving so much information that the Tories have got lots to attack them on?
I think the difficulty that Labour has on this is not so much what it's saying now, but what it's said for the last 3 years. So if you say now, well, we're not going to be able to keep this child benefit cut, then that may or may not be the sensible thing to do. But if you said for the last 3 years, this is terrible and awful and the worst thing that could ever have happened, then you begin to look like, you know, you really were passionate about this, but not so passionate they'd ever do anything about it. And I think the issue for Labour on this is not so much, is this the right thing that we're saying now? I think it pretty clearly is the right thing to be saying now. The danger is, are we already on the hook for the things we've been saying for the last 3 years that mean that actually, for all of the economic credibility message we put out now, there's no chance that people will be listening to it, because they say, well, hold on, you've just been saying we should spend more for the last 3 years. Do you really mean this now, or are you just saying it because, well, you feel you can't win an election without it?
Oh, thank you for that. And we must move on. But just before we do, it's worth mentioning an extraordinary leaked report from the IMF this week about Greece. They seem to be saying, oh, our strategy with Greece was entirely wrong. Larry, tell us a bit about that.
Well, they don't say it's entirely wrong. What they say was that they had to bend their rules in order to give Greece a bailout in the first place, because it didn't meet their normal terms for granting a bailout. And the assumptions on which they granted that bailout were, one, that there would be some systemic risk if Greece didn't get it, which was clearly true, and also that Greece's debts would be sustainable because the economy would actually perform in a certain way. And I mean, what they've admitted to is that they got their analysis completely wrong. They thought the Greek economy would actually contract by 5.5% between 2008 and the current time, and it's actually contracted by 17%. They thought unemployment might go to 15%, and it's currently 25%. So the pointy heads at the IMF got their austerity sums completely wrong, and they've now fessed up to it. So the people in Greece are actually feeling quite cock-a-hoop about it, because they've been saying this for some time, that you're killing the economy through too much austerity. And the IMF seems to be saying, well, yeah, we did overcook the austerity to a considerable degree. They're looking, if they had their time again, they would actually make it a much less austere programme and smooth it out over more years.
Well, thanks for that. We'll leave that there for now. And you can follow more on that story and everything else we've been talking about on guardian.co.uk/politics. Now, when David Cameron predicted back in 2010 that the next big scandal would involve lobbying, he was quickly proved right. In 2011, his defence secretary resigned after such a scandal, as did his party treasurer in 2012. Now, in 2013, he's lost a Tory backbencher, Patrick Mercer, to another sting operation. And in the House of Lords, a cross-party selection of peers have been accused of offering to do parliamentary work for payments. Seamus, here we are again. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Despite these murky cash for access deals, nothing illegal seems to have taken place. So, I mean, how do we deal with this? What's the solution?
you know, it is incredible. I mean, we're 4 years after the parliamentary expenses crisis, we're 20 years after the Cash for Questions scandal, and, you know, as you say, it's yet again happening again and again. So, I mean, there are things that should be done in Parliament. These people clearly did break the rules, and and they're going to be swept away. But
that's because they deny having any wrongdoing.
Yeah, they do.
The legal note there.
They're clearly going to be swept away, clearly, the reform that the government's coming up with, you know, the register which they'd promised 3 years ago, would have done nothing about this at all, because the lords in question would just not have been taken in by the sting, because they would have realised that it wasn't a real lobbying company. And the register doesn't cover lobbying directly by companies. But I mean, the idea of a recall, you know, recall vote, I mean, I personally think that's fine and should be supported. But, you know, it's not really getting to the heart of the problem, which goes far, far beyond, you know, this low-level Westminster sleaze. I mean, these people really are the small fry of dodgy lobbying. I mean, what Cameron was talking about, and actually what is going on throughout the government, is on a far, far bigger scale by lobbying companies, by corporates lobbying throughout the system. And as I've argued this week, I mean, actually we're talking about a far more corrupt system at a much deeper level, which is the process of revolving doors between civil servants, politicians, and corporate and city firms, which has actually infected the whole body politic and the whole public realm. And I think that is a very, very deep problem in Britain, which is not being properly addressed and has to be much more the focus of political controversy right now.
I mean, morally that doesn't sound right, but has there been any discernible effect of that system, that systemic problem that you describe?
Yeah, I mean, take the issue of light touch regulation of finance. I mean, who can seriously doubt that the very, very deep tentacles of the City of London and the financial system, in politics, in funding, think tanks, in academia, in the process by which civil servants and officials come back and forth with these companies, not in city companies, but their advisors, their accountants, and the consultants, that didn't affect, you know, the mentality and the ideology and the policies that were driven forward in the run-up to the crisis and the crash. And it's shaped, in fact, the entire period that we've lived through over the last 20 or 30 years. I mean, the entire privatisation drive, which, you know, on its own terms, and if you look at it rationally, really doesn't deliver what it's saying at all, doesn't deliver cheaper outcomes for the public sector, except at the expense of wages and conditions, is less transparent, less accountable. You know, why do those things happen? Part of the reason for it is because of this process that I'm talking about, this very deep entrenchment of the corporate sector and the financial sector within politics, within the civil service, and it happens at a very crude level. Not that people are handing over brown paper envelopes and straightforward bribes, but their entire, you know, careers and their incomes are determined by what kind of policies they carry out in government and when they're in the public sector, and what kind of companies and institutions they favour. You know, that's going to determine to a great extent what kind of jobs they have after they leave the government and civil service. And I think that's really the far deeper thing that needs to be addressed. This kind of stuff we've been talking about this week, which, you know, is entertaining at a low level and is obviously completely sleazy, is really at the margins of what is a much deeper problem of corruption within the public realm, I think.
Hopi, do you agree with that? Do you think we're missing the story? And do you think that these stories have any impact on the public?
To a certain extent. I should probably declare an interest, actually, because I was...
You should.
In my day job, I actually got one of these emails from one of these dodgy companies, and we sent them back and said, no, thank you very much, we don't want to meet you.
You don't fancy Fiji, then?
Not it was the
energy. But if they'd been on the register, it'd have been fine.
But yeah.
So they weren't even offering you a trip.
It was quite funny, because I remember clicking on the link and thinking, well, this looks dodgy.
Why?
Because it was a rubbish website. I mean, you know, it kind of had a blog about the supporting some Australian athlete or something like that, and it was just you know, you just thought, I don't know, your alarm bells just went off. And my suspicion upon this case is that people's in these sort of cases, people's greed overwhelms their better judgment, and I don't think actually that's something that is easily solved by lobbying regulation or anything like that. I support the lobbying regulation. I think it's absolutely the right thing to do. But you know, there's a moment where one of the people was saying, "Oh, if you give me £12,000 a month, I'm sure we can sort this." And I just think at that point, someone's, you know, pound signs are going off in their head, and actually any sensible kind of regulatory system would be telling you this is completely off. But on the broader point, I think. I think that it's actually a bit ahistorical. For instance, I don't think the Treasury view in the 1920s, which was of light touch, pro-austerity, let's crush every, squeeze everything, I don't think that was informed by a kind of revolving door between the Treasury and the city at that point. I think it was a common culture. But I also think, well, if you talk about a state spending division, well, Reggie Maudling or Jack Cunningham's father, actually Andy Cunningham, went to prison because he was involved in a corrupt state dispersal of funds. I think whenever money and government come into contact under any circumstances, you're going to end up with some people who for whatever reasons are vulnerable to financial inducements, and I think the only way you can really deal with that is absolute transparency. And any other system, really, you know, whether it's under a kind of entirely state system, I mean, corruption in the old Soviet Union was massive, and you know, people would, you know, divert resources to favoured relatives and families. In China, you've got the same problem. So I don't think it's specifically a British cultural problem. I think it's a problem of individuals and whether people feel they're being watched. And I think if you feel you're being watched, you'll probably make a more sensible decision.
It's quite sad in a way. You can see that someone could be bought for 12 grand a month, but for a quick trip to Fiji, maybe again.
It's a bit cheap, isn't it?
It is a bit, really. Let's flip it a bit, Larry, because why do the firms themselves seek to lobby in this way? Is it actually an effective tactic for them?
I'm not sure whether it is for the individual companies.
Firms and governments,
presumably, they think it must be, otherwise the companies wouldn't be behaving in a particularly rational way. I mean, they must think there's something in it for them, otherwise why would they be doing it? I mean, I think there are two issues, really. One is the sort of money issue, the money question, and the other is the power and influence question. So the overt sign of it is cash for access and sleaze and so on. But I agree with Seamus, the real issue is what sort of influence and power are the lobbyists actually getting. And that really has changed a bit, I think, over the last 30 or 40 years. There's always been, I mean, I agree, there's always been a question of corruption and sleaziness. But what's really changed, I think, is the lobbying power of the corporate sector. I think that has changed. And, you know, there are people at the Bank of England, for example, quite senior people, who would say that there has been institutional capture of the Treasury by the city in the last 15 or 20 years. And I think that's hard to deny. It has been captured by the city. I mean, look at the fact that, you know, when the five tests for Britain joining the euro were drawn up, there was one test which was specifically about whether it would be good for the financial sector. There was no test for whether it would be good for manufacturing, but there was a specific test about whether it would be good for the city of London. And, you know, look at another, you know, since the crash, the banking sector has been really assiduous in using every bit of influence it can to water down proposals for tighter regulation. I mean, specifically, you know, financial transaction tax, the old Robin Hood tax, that's really been kicked into touch in this country purely, I think, by the power and influence of the city. So, I mean, there are obviously these high-profile cases and they don't do politics any good, but actually, at a deeper level, there is an awful lot going on which has quite profound consequences that people don't really know anything about at all.
So people will be concerned about that, but I'll be presumably more concerned about the fact that you just can't get rid of these people. I mean, you know, when there were cases, allegations made against them, sometimes they're proven, and sometimes peers go to jail and then still end up in the House of Lords.
I mean, this is constant problem in the House of Lords, and also I think in the Commons. I mean, I think the proposals for recall are important. I think in the end, actually, in the Commons, it tends to be shame and criminal disgrace that kind of leads people to actually take the step of resigning. In the Lords, I think it tends to really just to be the fact that it's very, very difficult actually to get rid of anyone. I mean, how do you, you know, if someone is appointed to a peerage for life, there isn't actually a clear mechanism for getting rid of anyone. And they've been trying to introduce this and trying to introduce an expulsion mechanism. But unfortunately, there is the number of constitutional issues that are then raised by people who may or may not be self-interested in this, partly because there are a number of people who don't want to open the door to retirement in the House of Lords rather than expulsion. It makes it very, very complicated indeed. And I think this has got to change. You've got to have a mechanism that, you know, once you've got a criminal conviction, you don't just disappear for 2 years and then come back once it's spent.
The obvious solution to that problem is elections. And the problem with the House of Lords is it's an unelected, undemocratic chamber. And if that problem was solved, it would solve this problem with it. So I'm afraid that's a very, very straightforward reflection of the undemocratic nature of the parliamentary system in Britain. But just to come back on the points about that Hoppy made, which I think is completely correct, obviously, that, you know, in the 20s and 30s, you know, there wasn't this level of direct corporate corruption in the state. The civil service was definitely much cleaner, and yet you still had these completely reactionary and irrational economic policies being driven through, or irrational for the majority of people anyway. And I think that clearly reflected a class interest at the heart of the state rather than direct lobbying or corruption. But I think it is the case clearly that this situation has got dramatically worse in the last period, in the last, say, 25, 30 years, the last generation. It's not confined to Britain at all. I mean, it's worse probably in America and other countries. But it's something that's, I think, changed quite a lot here, and people aren't properly aware of it. It's not a focus of political debate as it should be. And I think there are clear changes that could be made, which would make it, but they're quite radical changes, that would make the problem much, much better. I mean, one factor that's driven this is the huge inflation of salaries and rewards in the private sector, the boardroom excess, which obviously makes the lure of going to work in the corporate sector for civil servants much, much greater. There's privatisation, as I mentioned, but there should be a quite straightforward ban on politicians and civil servants going to work for private companies within a very significant period, which doesn't exist at all at the moment. So there are things like that that could be done and should be done.
Well, we'll see if anything is done. The government, of course, did identify this as a priority. We shall see. But that's all we have time for now. My thanks to Larry Elliott, Seamus Milne and Hopi Sen. The producer of this podcast was Phil Maynard. I'm Hugh Muir. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
Do you work in public services? Have you and your team made a difference this year? The Guardian Public Services Awards reward innovation and best practice across all public services. If you're making your sector more innovative, efficient, and imaginative, enter now to get the recognition you deserve. For more information and to enter, visit guardian.co.uk/public services awards. The deadline is midnight on Friday, the 12th of July. Terms and conditions apply.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.